This is a Jewish TV channel presentation. Welcome to Talking Point, where controversial subjects are brought into sharp focus. Conversations with JTVC show host Laura Kessler comes up next.
Good evening. Welcome to Talking Point. I'm Laura Kessler. Many of us have a different Jewish identity now than we had on October 6th. After October 7th, many who never identified as Jewish are now lighting Shabbat candles. People who never wore a Star of David are now wearing one. Some have also stopped doing so and worry whether it's safe to leave a mezuzah up or look visibly Jewish on a college campus. In some places, it's now safer to hide one's Jewish identity in order to get a fair grade in class or even get equal access to health care without bias. But many Jews have ultimately decided they'd rather be hated for who they are than loved for who they are not. Jews have struggled with identity issues from the beginning of time, and some even changed their names to mark the transformation. Avram became Abraham after questioning idolatry in his father's store and became the patriarch to three major religions. Jacob was renamed Israel after wrestling all night with an angel. Esther was the alias name for Hadassah, her real Jewish name, which she used in order to save the Jews from genocide by becoming the queen of Persia. Joseph didn't change his name, but he had to adapt to dramatic chapters in his life, going from favorite son to slave, and then second most powerful man in Egypt. Ruth transformed from a Moabite widow to the first Jewish convert and ancestor to King David. King David transformed from an introverted shepherd to a dynamic king who presided over the golden age of Judaism in Jerusalem. And we can't forget Moses. Born a Jewish baby, became a fully assimilated Egyptian prince, went on to reclaim his Judaism, becoming arguably the greatest Jewish leader in our history, and later renamed yet again Moshe Rabbeinu to recognize his transformation into a full-fledged spiritual leader. What's in a name and a Jewish identity? Everything. These transformations, whether through name changes, shifts in social status, or profound personal growth, illustrate the basic internal spirit of the Jewish people. We are history's ultimate survivors. We've built and rebuilt ourselves from the ashes of the phoenix many, many times. Some even joke it's basically the family business. One of the secrets of Jewish success is that we seem to have collectively mastered the tools that enable the survival of the fittest. It's the reason students in Asia study the Talmud to acquire the same skills through intellectual study of Torah principles, much the same way Westerners like to study Buddhism for spirituality. We're resilient and resourceful. We demand excellence from ourselves, and we put in the work to make it happen. When we're down and out, we don't riot and blame others. We just start a new venture or get a second master's degree. We don't dwell in our trauma. We rebuild ourselves from it. Or as some of our interfaith allies like to say, we are victors and not victims. The themes that connect the Holocaust to October 7th our identity, resilience, and the ability to move forward despite abandonment from seemingly the entire world, and reinvent ourselves after dehumanization and loss of identity. My guest today has had three identities in her life and three different names, being one of the youngest Holocaust survivors at the tender age of four. Janet Singer Applefield is an 88-year-old child survivor of the Holocaust, a notable speaker and Holocaust educator, and the author of Becoming Janet, Finding Myself in the Holocaust, soon to be released in May. She earned her Master of Social Work at Boston University and practiced as a clinical social worker in the court system with perpetrators of hate crimes in the greater Boston area, and served geriatric clients for over 30 years. When Janet first arrived in the U.S. in 1947, her father insisted that she relay to him everything she could remember since they were separated in 1942, so that he could capture it in writing. During his life, they never spoke about their collective torture. However, she discovered the 7 handwritten pages in 1984 in a box of yellowed papers and translated the document and it became a blueprint for her self-discovery. Janet learned of those who saved her during the war, and she was able to meet her rescuers in person, who are now recognized as Righteous Among the Nations at Yad Vashem in Israel. She speaks openly about her experiences with thousands of people each year through regular speaking engagements, and has also helped testify before the Massachusetts legislature on the occasion of mandating statewide genocide education. One of the lessons we can learn from Janet and other Holocaust survivors is how to be resilient after trauma and successfully transform our identities for a new chapter of survival and healing after unimaginable loss. And we're so honored to have her with us today. Welcome, Janet.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's great to be with you. There's so much I want to ask you about, and I know your book has not come out just yet, so people will be reading it, but I want to ask you, what are the themes in your book that you feel are especially important for your readers to understand?
I think my memoir is very interesting for readers because it touches on so many different themes, such as identity, as you just mentioned in your introduction, resilience, loss, trauma. It deals with all those issues. And I was not in any camps. I was a hidden child. I was hiding in plain sight, which was very different from many other Holocaust memoirs, because I always knew that I was Jewish, and I had to keep it a secret. Even at that very young age, I had to be silent and mostly invisible, so I would not divulge the secret.
Wow, and you're so visible now. It's been quite an evolution for you. Can you tell us a little bit about your story, the basic story, so people understand just how remarkable it was? You were only four, one of the youngest Holocaust survivors.
So I was born in Krakow, Poland, and I lived with my parents and a baby sister and a very large extended family in a town 50 miles south of the city of Krakow. I had a wonderful childhood, and I have wonderful recollections of the first 4 years of my life. But very abruptly and suddenly, everything changed. September 1st, 1939, when the German army attacked Poland. So the next several months, we were trying to escape. My parents made several attempts at escaping, but when there were no options left, they realized they had to do this unthinkable thing, and that is to give me away. They had just lost a baby. My baby sister died of diphtheria in Russia, and then they had to. They made the decision, the agonizing decision of giving me away. So for the next several years, I was with different people, strangers, and I ended up, some were kind, some were not good people. That's another theme in the story, the theme of evil and goodness. You know, ordinary people, some were good and some were evil. At one point, I was left on the street. I was abandoned, and I was picked off the street by a total stranger, ended up on a farm, and eventually ended up in an orphanage where my dad found me.
Wow. That's a lot for a child to take in.
It was difficult because I didn't understand. I was so little. I didn't understand what was happening, but I knew something really terrible was going on, because when I was still with my parents, you know, and my grandparents, people were crying and whispering because they didn't want me to know or understand what was going on. It was difficult. And then everybody disappeared, and I didn't understand where do they go? You know, my wonderful family was gone.
Sure, sure. Tell us about your three different names.
So my birth name was Gustava, and my nickname was Gija, which means baby in Polish. And then when I was with my second caregiver, she was able to obtain a birth certificate from a Catholic priest of a deceased Polish Catholic girl who died. So I took on her identity. Her name was Krystyna Antoszkiewicz. So
wow.
That was my new name. And my new nickname was Krysia. So I had a new identity.
Wow. And then when did you become Janet?
I became Janet when I arrived in the United States. My uncle took me to school. I had never gone to school before, but I knew how to read and write in Polish, but obviously not in English. And my uncle took me to elementary school, and right there in the school office, he said, "What name do you want? You have to have an American name." So that question caught me by a complete surprise. I thought for a moment, and I came up with the name Jeanette, because we had a cousin who was French. She was from Paris. She used to visit us in the summertime, and her name was Jeanette, and she was very beautiful and glamorous, and she had long red nails. So I said to my uncle, Jeanette, but he turned to the school secretary, and he said, "Her name is Janet." So that's how I became Janet.
Wow. That's so much with that. I have to ask, just we've been talking a lot about Jewish trauma and mental health in the last few episodes, and you're also a retired certified social worker. How do you maintain your own mental health, given that you share your story more than 35 times every year?
When I started to speak, that was very rewarding and very therapeutic for me. And when I have students who come up to me and share their own difficult issues and tell me that hearing my experiences has helped them, that really is food for my soul. It helps me a lot to know that my speaking and my story helps others, because I feel like I'm a witness of history, and I feel I'm the voice for all those victims whose voices were silenced. And I find that it's my commitment to keep doing this as long as I can.
Absolutely. When did you start telling your story?
I started to speak in early 80s. I joined an organization called Facing History and Ourselves. It's an educational organization that has developed a curriculum of how to teach about genocide and obviously the Holocaust. So once I started speaking through their auspices, I started to feel a lot better about what had happened to me.
Yeah, that's healthy. But you and your father never spoke about it, right? So when you and your father came to the U.S., did you try to hide your Jewish identity? Were you afraid to be Jewish? And what, if anything, did you and your dad acknowledge about the past?
We did not speak about the past because survivors weren't able to speak about what happened. Those stories were unspeakable. And people in this country had a hard time hearing these horrendous stories. So we didn't speak. Also, I never wanted to upset my dad. He had suffered so much. He had been through three concentration camps. And he used to have terrible nightmares that would wake me up. And so I never wanted to upset him, so I never brought anything up. Sadly, we didn't speak about what happened to us. I wish I had spoken more with him, and I wish I had asked more questions. but we didn't.
In a way, it's as if he gave you the tools to be able to have that long-term conversation, though, anyway, even though you didn't, don't you feel? Because it seems like it's very... Go ahead, sorry.
I was just going to say, yes, you're right. I think his 7 pages of writing, what has happened to me, I think that was the genesis of my writing the memoir, because I always had that, and I remember that. And I started to think about writing long, long time ago, but finally it came to fruition now.
Well, it seems like even though he was going through his own trauma, then, you know, I can only imagine what your parents must have been feeling, having just lost a child and then just the heart-wrenching, you know, thought of giving you up. But it saved you, though, and you were reunited,
right,
at least with your father.
Right.
You know, and it's as if he had enough, you know, he had the wisdom and he had enough strength to know that he could plant that seed for later, which I think is such a beautiful thing. And, you know, I think he'd be very proud of you and what you've done. And with this, and you share your story, but you seem to especially connect well with students. What, tell me a little bit more about your connection with the students and why you feel it's so important to share your story with them.
I think it's so important because Holocaust education is at its lowest, I think, at this point. Only 23 states have passed the genocide education mandate to teach in middle schools and high school. I think students hearing firsthand accounts of what really happened is very worthwhile. And I have so many students writing to me, like thousands of letters I receive every year. Also, after I finish my presentation, they come up to me and share some of their difficulties. And I'm so honored that they are trusting of me to share their own hardships. One girl came up and said, you know, she said, I'm Jewish, but sometimes I'm afraid to acknowledge that, but you've taught me to be braver. And another student came up to me and said, this was a very large Catholic high school, 1,100 students were in the auditorium listening to my story. One young man came up and said, how do I speak to my parents who are racist? And that was like the most difficult question I had been asked. I was so honored that he trusted me to ask that such a question. So that's how I take care of myself. That gives me strength, it gives me hope, and it inspires me.
What did you tell him? That's a tough question.
Well, that was a tough question. And I first asked him whether he would be safe to speak to his parents. And he said yes. And then I advised that he start a conversation and talk to them about what he is learning in school about social justice, about accepting people for who they are. And sometimes it's difficult for him to hear very negative things said about people who are not like they are. And I also advised him not to be, you know, not to point fingers and not to be angry and not to start an argument, but just start a conversation.
Yeah, I think, how old were you when you first came over?
I was 11, almost 12.
Oh, very young. And was
I was
it,
very
were you
young,
and your,
yeah.
And sorry. Was it only you and your father were the only survivors from your family?
Yes. Well, my mother did not survive. And actually, when we first came, we came on a 90-day visitor's visa. Actually, it was a medical visa because my father was shot when he was in the camp in the face, and the bullet lodged under his cheekbone. Mm. So that bullet had to remain there. But we got a medical visa to come here for him to have his bullet removed. So we came on a 90-day visa, and 90 days we had another visa to go to Venezuela. The only way we could remain in this country is if my father got married to an American citizen. So the family looked around and they found him a wife. And my father got married within that short period of time. And one of my grandfathers survived in Russia. He and my aunt and uncle were sent to Siberia, and they worked as slave laborers in Siberia, and they survived. But aside from that, we were the only survivors.
Wow. And to be at such an impressionable age, dealing with that must have been so hard for you. With everything, the cultural difference, all of it, you know, most of us have never had to change our identities even once, and you've had to change yours many times. It's just with changing all of that. How did you adapt? What worked for you? What strategies? What made you resilient? And especially things that today many, many Jewish and Israeli kids and kids in North America dealing with things are dealing with. You know, what made you survive and stay so resilient?
I think I learned as a very young child to adapt to any situation. I didn't have a choice. I had to. And that was a good thing to have learned. So I was able to accept whatever came at me. So when I first came, of course, I had to adjust to new school, new stepmother, new language, new name. Everything was new. I was very fortunate because I was accepted in school. I wasn't bullied. I wasn't teased. Except in my eighth grade teacher always referred to me as that little foreign girl. I was trying to fit in and not stand out, and that's how she identified me. But I was very fortunate. I had a group of girlfriends who really took me under their wing and really helped me out. So that was very, very useful. I adapted well to school. I was a good student. I caught on very quickly. I was active in high school and lots of different school activities. But then I got married at age 19. So this was the 50s. When young women, girls, really girls, married young, that's what was expected. And I got married, but I promised my parents I would finish college, and I kept my promise. I carried a baby to class, and I got my BA, and then, of course, later on continued, and I got my master's degree.
Well, and that really goes to the story of we survive, we thrive, we reinvent ourselves. And it sounds like you did exactly that. Was this in Boston, or were you in a different part of the
no,
country at that time?
No, that was in New Jersey. That's where we settled because my father had a brother. There were six brothers. He was one of six. Three survived, my father being one of them, and then three were murdered. So one of the uncles was a student in Italy when the war broke out, and he escaped on the last ship to China. And then when the Chinese and the Japanese went to war, he became a prisoner of war of the Japanese, and he was in a Japanese prison. But after the war ended, he came to the United States. So we moved in with my uncle and his new American wife. And we settled in New Jersey.
Now, you're not just a Holocaust survivor, you're also a retired LCSW who specialized in geriatric populations. So you have a lot of viewpoints on this issue as far as, you know, many survivors, they don't want to talk about their horrific experiences during the war. And I know a lot of people, maybe yourself included, were traumatized by Ukraine. And, you know, since before October 7th, I'm wondering your thoughts on that. You know, the ones that don't speak, how recent events, including Ukraine and of course October 7th, have affected people, and you know, what continues to inspire you to share your story.
You mentioned Ukraine, and when that war started last year, I really was triggered because that's where my baby sister died, and that's where she's buried. Although I don't know where she's buried, I have never seen her gravesite, but all I could think was of bombs falling on the grave. And it really touched me very deeply. And of course, the October 7th attack was horrendous, and it also affected me very, very deeply. I know some, many Holocaust survivors who had not been able to speak. I just felt this great sense of responsibility and obligation that this story had to be out there, that I had to speak because, as I mentioned earlier, I feel I'm the voice for those who never had a chance to speak. So I continue to do that.
And how have the tragic events of October 7th affected or changed you and the work you do? We see so much anti-Semitism all over the world right now, and you're meeting with children every day. So how has it personally affected you, and how has it changed the work?
It has affected me because I feel like, I almost feel like I have a mark on my back that I, you know, I could be attacked. You know, I have a new website and I list the places where I go, but I don't list where, you know, the address, because I'm afraid. I'm afraid when I walk into a school, the thought comes to my mind, you know, what if there's some anti-Semitic event there, or there's a shooting, or so I definitely have been, you know, I feel deeply what has happened October 7th. I feel it has affected how I feel, although it has not stopped me in my work. I feel determined to keep doing what I'm doing, because as you said, we Jews reinvent ourselves. We are strong, and we have to keep going, and we have to be helpful and, you know, do our best. You know, anti-Semitism has existed for centuries, and Judaism is one of the oldest religions, and yet we survive, we persevere, and we get through it.
You've seen anti-Semitism morph into different forms, even in your own lifetime. And now what we're seeing is anti-Zionism being coded as a new way to deal with anti-Semitism, even though many times they deny it. And this is hard, where a lot of kids that may have different levels of Jewish identity or not even really being aware much of their Judaism until recently. I hear a lot of adults even saying that. So I'm curious, with all of that in the background, what does Israel mean to you? And how do you relate any of that with the kids? What advice would you give the kids as they're navigating a post-October 7th world with maybe a new identity in a different way of their own, with broken friendships, feeling left behind of social circles and groups? And, you know, what advice would you give to them when they're dealing with this new anti-Semitism that is really anti-Israel?
I feel strongly about Israel. I think that the Jewish people have to have a state of their own, and
I am deeply troubled by this new form of anti-Semitism that people, you know, some people are against the Israeli government, and they have a right to feel that way, but they combine the, you know, the Jews, all Jews, with the current government. You know, I feel troubled, disappointed, angry, worried, all of the above, but at the same time, I feel that we can persevere, and I think Jewish students, I think it's important not to be alone with their pain and their fear, and to join, you know, groups like Hillel on campuses and other Jewish organizations, and talk with people, like-minded people. It's most important not to feel isolated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And what action would you like the viewers to take that are listening? You know, can you tell them about your book and specifically the details of that? What action would you like our audience to take?
Well, I'm very excited with my new memoir, which is called Becoming Janet, Finding Myself in the Holocaust. I would love if people could follow me on social media. I'm on Facebook and on, oh, I can't think of the other.
Twitter? Instagram?
Yeah, Instagram. Sorry, I forgot. And they can reach me at Janet Applefield. I also have a website, janetapplefield.com, and they can order the book through the on the website. So I think, you know, reading my memoir and being as proactive as people can be, writing letters to the editors, calling their congressmen, joining groups, speaking out against any type of injustice, kids befriending new students in school who, you know, who are different than they are, befriending them. Even the smallest acts of kindness have ripple effects. So that would be my wish for everybody.
Yeah, that's a good list there. And we will put all of the things you mentioned on the episode webpage so people can follow you on your social media, and they can advance order your book now, right? So we'll put links
yes.
up for that as well in your website.
I would like to make one addition. I would love my book to be adapted in as part of the school curriculum. Because from my experience, the books that are mostly read and assigned in school are Elie Wiesel's Night and Anne Frank's journal. I think this book would lend itself very well for teachers and students. In the back of the book, there's a study guide that explores very important themes. So that would be my hope.
Yeah. And you gave us the study guides that we can share with the listeners. That's correct, right?
That's right.
Yeah, this is so important because there's been really quite a big discussion about Holocaust education, and people are saying it's so important to tie it to the present, not just keep it stored away in the past. And that's what we've tried to do today, to really talk about the people who, you know, make the universal message of reinvention, which really is the Jewish story. And you're an inspiring example of that, Janet. I really appreciate you being here with us.
Thank you so much.
Do you have time? Yes. We like to end on our signature lightning round, which is a little bit more uplifting when we talk about all these heavy things. So if you have a few more minutes, I'd like to ask you a couple of those. Is that okay?
Of course.
Okay. Why are you proud to be a Jew?
I am proud to be a Jew because I think it was what really saved me. By that I mean, I was all alone. I didn't understand what was happening. I was scared. I was crying in my sleep. But I remembered the holidays. I remembered the traditions. I remembered cooking and baking with my mother and my grandmother. And I think those traditions and memories is what really kept me through the war. So, you know, I am also proud because Jews have had such huge influence globally on every aspect of society, and I'm proud of that. And we are strong. We're very small in terms of numbers. When I checked the population of Jews in the world, I was really surprised. And yet we have survived and we thrive and we will continue to do this again and again.
Yeah. Who are your Jewish role models?
Well, my dad, for the most part, I think he was like the most wonderful role model. He was kind. He was not bitter or hateful after all that he went through. And he taught me to accept people on the basis of their character and their actions. And he didn't believe that all Germans were bad. He felt there were good people and there were bad people in the world. And I think he taught me very important lessons. The other people that I have admired is Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and also Elie Wiesel. Those are some of the people that I have admired.
What concerns you most about the present situation in relation to the Jewish people?
I'm worried for my grandchildren and great-grandchildren. I would like them to be in a more peaceful world and not to be afraid to be Jewish. But once again, they will be strong and they will thrive.
What makes you mad?
I'm angry with the politicians. I'm angry with people who believe lies and myths and people who don't want to learn the truth.
For those who look up to you, what do you want them to remember?
I would like them to remember that I have made a difference, a little bit of a difference in the world, and that I was a good person.
I think that's definitely going to happen. And finally, what's your outlook on the future of the Jewish people? Are you hopeful?
I'm definitely hopeful. I know that we will survive. This is a terrible thing that has happened again since the Holocaust, but I know that we will survive and we will do well, as we always have and we always will.
Janet Singer Applefield, thank you for your time, all the work you're doing at age 88 years young to help educate our youth and also some big kids too. I hope everyone reads your book or gets to hear you speak, and we wish you all the best, and please keep in touch.
Thank you so much. I appreciate the interview.
Well, that's it for this edition of Talking Point. Join us next time as we begin a new series on medical anti-Semitism as we speak to the leaders of the American Jewish Medical Association about the disturbing increase of bias in healthcare environments. You don't want to miss this. For Jewish TV Channel, I'm Laura Kessler. Stay safe and see you next time.